This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The first World Baseball Classic got underway yesterday in Tokyo. Among the first round Pool A winners were Japan, which slipped by China 18-2, and Korea, which beat Chinese Taipei 2-0. Late last night, Korea beat China 10-1. Japan is currently playing Chinese Taipei. On Tuesday, Pools B, C, and D begin play in Phoenix, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Orlando, Florida, respectively. Joining me now on the phone from Phoenix to discuss the tournament is Contra Costa Times columnist Rick Hurd. Rick, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The World Baseball Classic features teams handpicked by Major League Baseball and the Players Association. How did those entities decide on this particular group of 16 teams?
Well, I think you obviously had your powerhouses. I think everybody knows that the Dominican Republic and Venezuela in Cuba and the United States, just to throw out four names right there, have traditionally been dominant, and Japan is right there. So I think the idea was to try to get as many of the dominant countries at full strength as possible to compete and see how it went. A lot of people ask why Major League Baseball is doing this. To me, this is about one thing, and it's about expanding interest worldwide. It's not so much about the interest that it's going to gain here in the United States. It's about the interest that it's going to gain in some baseball-playing countries and in some non-baseball-playing countries.
So the real measure of the tournament's success will not be who wins, but how many people in Chinese Taipei buy New York Yankees caps when
it's over. Exactly. How many people in China are going to go out and buy that Roger Clemens jersey? And how many people in South Africa are going to go out and buy that Derek Jeter jersey? You know, I think it's a good idea by Major League Baseball to finally do this. They've kind of lagged behind the NBA as far as trying to promote their game internationally, and they're playing catch up, and I think this is going to help. It's not going to be a tournament without flaws, but as this tournament goes along, we'll see what those flaws are, and I think in 4 years they'll be able to iron out quite a few of them.
You're in Phoenix, where the Pool B games will be played. The USA would seem to be the powerhouse of that group, as you've suggested, but a quick glance at the rosters of Mexico and even Canada would suggest the American team shouldn't feel too comfortable, don't you think?
No, absolutely. I think that the United States is going to have their hands full to try to get a medal in this tournament. I absolutely do. It only takes one hot pitcher to shut you down, and Canada is capable of doing that, as is Mexico. So I think the United States is going to have to be ready to play from game one. I don't think South Africa necessarily belongs in that pool. I've seen them practice, and they're not going to shock anybody, believe me. But the other three teams, the United States can't take those teams lightly.
Would you like to predict any other first-round upsets?
You know, every time I predict, I walk away with egg on my face.
You'll be comfortable here on Only a Game, then. We have commentators famous for it.
I think Cuba, without question, is going to come out. If I had to pick who I think is going to win this tournament, I think Cuba has a terrific chance because they're going to have major league quality talent across the board. And this is a very important tournament to them, unlike the other countries who have players who are trying to get ready for the major league season. Cuba does not have that, and they've taken their best players, and it's become a very important deal down there. And I think it's going to be phenomenal to see some of the talent that country has. It'll be interesting to see whether there's any problems with defections. I like Venezuela a lot because of the pitching. I like the Dominican Republic a lot because of the lineup, even though they've lost a couple guys, Manny Ramirez and Vladimir Guerrero. And I like the United States, and I like Japan. To me, those five teams, it's five teams to me for three medals.
So far, there's been more coverage of the controversy over the tournament taking major league players out of spring training than there has been about the event as, just a sporting event. Or am I wrong? Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, I think that's how the coverage has been here. I think if you went to other countries, I think if you went down to Venezuela right now, or if you went to the Dominican Republic right now, or if you went to Japan right now, I think the tournament has been the people are very excited about the tournament down there. But I think in the United States, I think there's just kind of a strange curiosity. It's going up against the NCAA tournaments in a couple weeks, and that obviously a lot of people in the United States focus on that. It's competing against spring training. It doesn't have every great player in the United States playing. And I think, when you lose a Barry Bonds right off the bat and you lose some of the other guys that have pulled out for a variety of reasons, I think we live in a society now where hey, if our best guys aren't going to be there, then I'm not going to bother paying attention. Mm. And I think that's part of it. It's new. And anything new, it takes a while to grab people's attention in our society because we live soundbite to soundbite, and it really takes a lot to grab. You know, we live in an age where there's 500 things to watch on television at any time. It's going to take a lot to grab our attention, and we're usually slow to warm up to things.
Rick Hurd is a columnist for the Contra Costa Times. He joined me on the line from Phoenix. Rick, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
On Tuesday, the South African baseball squad begins play against its more highly regarded Pool B opponents, Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. Only a game Sean Cole caught up with the South African team in Cape Town, South Africa, where baseball itself is something of an underdog, and he files this report.
It's funny to see a baseball diamond in Cape Town. This is a place where kids play cricket in the park just for kicks, where soccer and rugby are big news. But at the P.P. Smit Field, about 12 miles from the center of the city, the World Baseball Classic team is training as though baseball were as South African as Nelson Mandela and driving on the left-hand side of the road. They work out cheerfully in the roasting sun, a catch-and-throw drill called cuts and relays.
Attaboy, pup.
Standard batting practice.
Oh, nicely done, John. Very good.
All under the tutelage of general manager Rick Mignante, an Oakland A's scout in his late 50s, who's really friendly with all the players.
How are you, Ash?
Good, thanks.
Everything good, buddy?
Mignante and two other American coaches were enlisted to South Africa by Major League Baseball. He also worked with some of these same players at an MLB academy in Italy last year. He freely admits that this team is in something of a David and Goliath situation.
They are an underdog, but anything can happen, and we want to stay optimistic and give it our best effort. But certainly when you're playing against the likes of Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez and Chase Utley and Jason Veritek and Derek Lee and Ken Griffey and on and on and on, yes, the playing field truly isn't level.
Most of the South African players are in their teens and 20s. Surprisingly, most of them are white, with a few mixed race and Indian kids here and there. All of them have to fit training into their work and school schedules. Baseball's an amateur sport in South Africa. The leagues are broken down regionally, with interregional competitions every year for every age group. Some of the high school players might work their way up into an adult league early. A few of the guys on this team have even played minor league ball in the States.
John Phillips, he played. He was signed by the Brewers, subsequently released. Brett Willenberg, he was a Royal player. And Nick Dempsey, he was with the Expos, the Indians, I think, and the Dodgers, the big guy.
But that doesn't mean they aren't nervous about playing the Americans on Friday. Brett Willenberg, the former Kansas City Royals rookie, told me he'd be lying if he said he wasn't scared to face the likes of Derek Jeter and Roger Clemens.
But it's like a challenge that I know who they are, but they don't know who I am, and they don't know what I can do.
Do you feel like that gives you an advantage, the sort of, like, unknown quantity?
I think it does, actually. They might not know what you're capable of, you know, and they might just accidentally leave one there, and, you know, who knows, you might hit a home run, and that could cost them to go into the playoffs, making the biggest upset in, you know.
In world history.
Yeah, in world history, so yeah.
Really, all of the players I talked to were more excited than scared. A couple of them were downright starstruck, like 18-year-old utility player Ashley Scott.
I mean, I was thinking about it. Jeez, I would love to get an autograph or get one of Jeter's caps or something. It's crazy, I mean.
Which is just what pitching coach Lee Smith is worried about.
It's going to be like we're going to a card show and we got half the kids trying to get autographs, you know? So I'm like, hey, we're playing here now.
When I say Lee Smith, I mean the Lee Smith. Major League Baseball's record holder for most saves in a career, 478 of them. He pitched for the Cubs, Red Sox, Cardinals, Yankees, Orioles, Angels, Reds, and Expos before retiring in 1997. In fact, he showed up to training in Cincinnati pants and a San Francisco jacket. He says he's not used to players being as relaxed as the South Africans are.
The guys here are so laid back, you know. The guys are so laid back, you know. And I'm like, hey, when we get out there, we're going to be playing against big leagues. We ain't got time. So, okay, we'll get them next inning. You know, these guys could beat us into the ground in one inning. So I'm like, you got to go out there and take each pitch. You're like, you know what, this might be my last pitch. But the whole atmosphere, I think, probably in all of South Africa is sort of like laid back.
Smith says he didn't know there was baseball in South Africa, which isn't surprising. A lot of South Africans don't know there's baseball in South Africa. And of course, a lot of Americans don't know much about South Africa to begin with.
I think there's a misnomer about South Africa, that we all just about lions and tigers and that type of thing.
Or more to the point about rugby and soccer
right.
And cricket.
Correct.
This is Edwin Bennett, executive director of the South African Baseball Union. I met him at the airport in Cape Town as he was heading back home to Johannesburg.
But baseball has been played in this country since 1898, and it was American miners who worked in the mines of Johannesburg who started baseball.
And as in the States, baseball begat softball.
Softballers and the baseballers used to play at the same tournament, and so mothers and fathers played the sport. Their children played the sport. The family tradition goes right down to grandmothers having played the sport, softball, and grandfathers having played the sport of baseball.
As a result, a lot of the players on South Africa's national team had the same response when I asked them how they got involved in the game.
My dad played for an old club since the 50s or something.
My mom played softball, and I mean, my dad was her coach.
My dad used to play baseball, and I've been playing since I was about 5 years old.
Since I was 6 years old.
Well, I started off when I was 4.
I could have chosen between cricket or baseball, and I chose baseball.
So I asked why, expecting them to wax poetic about the crack of the bat and the roar of the crowd in a way that you really can't with cricket. But their answer was a lot more practical than that.
It's a quicker game.
You get to bat 4 times in a game, and you get to catch a lot of balls. In cricket, you know, you only get to bat once in a game, and you might only catch 1 ball in a game.
Cricket, there's no speed in it.
But baseball's different. It's short. It's a lot quicker.
What do your friends say when you tell them you're a baseball player?
They ask, what is it?
They ask, what is it?
Yeah.
The hope is that, if nothing else, South Africa's turn at the World Baseball Classic will raise the profile of the sport in South Africa, as well as just being a great cross-cultural experience for all involved, players and coaches. In fact, sometimes the coaches seem to be in as much awe as the players.
Oh, that guy had a cricket bat with him. I wanted to see that thing.
This is Rick Manyante again.
The guy was sitting in the stands there. He had a cricket bat.
You haven't seen a cricket bat before?
Only a picture of one.
Huh.
Yeah. What do they cost?
For only a game, I'm Sean Cole in Cape Town, South Africa.
The pro bat.
Good one's about 3,000 rand,
which is
three divided by six, about $500.
$500. Do they break?
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. One man's obsession with the eternal struggle of Chapel Hill's righteous forces against the Dark Prince's indigo demons. But first, more than 1,300 dogs and 80 mushers will start the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race today in Anchorage, Alaska. The Iditarod, with its $750,000 purse and major media coverage, is considered mushing's foremost competition. But according to some purists, real mushers go in for Alaska's other 1,000-mile race, the Yukon Quest, which offers modest prize money to the relatively few entrants brave enough to follow historic gold rush and mail delivery routes that cut through the Yukon territory of Alaska and Canada. From member station KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska, Libby Casey reports.
Going into this year's Yukon Quest, defending champion Lance Mackey already knew tough. The born and raised Alaskan grew up on a dog sled and has tackled all of Alaska's big mushing races. He even survived throat cancer a few years ago. But last month, on his way to a second Quest victory, Lance Mackey had the ride of his life.
I don't ever think I've been quite so scared nor out of control. It was absolutely insane. But worth every minute. What a ride. That's the adrenaline we look for, I think. It was just absolutely crazy going down there.
Mackey endured the harrowing descent of Eagle Summit, one of the Yukon Quest's 4 mountain peaks. The trail was raw from lack of snow and covered in ice and exposed rock. With a team of 14 keyed-up, powerful dogs, all Mackey could do was brace the sled, scrape its claw-like break into the ice, and hang on tight. Once safely over the mountain and into the small town checkpoint of central Alaska, Mackey packed up food and dog booties for the next 75-mile stretch. Checkpoints are full of the bustle of officials and veterinarians, but on the trail, mushers and dogs are on their own. Outside help isn't allowed, except at the race's halfway point when teams get a rest. Mackey's sled had taken a beating, and he faced fixing it alone.
Nobody's liable for us, except for us. You know, and there's no resources out there. There's no means of really calling for help. You know, and that can kind of be rewarding and yet scary in the same sense because, you know, there are things that happen out there.
Things like blizzards, like the one that trapped five teams on Eagle Summit after Mackey and other race leaders passed over top. With conditions too severe to send out snowmobiles or planes, Quest officials took the drastic step of sending in the National Guard. A Black Hawk helicopter plucked five mushers and more than 60 dogs off the mountain. All were safe, but the rescue counted as outside help, so officials forced the teams to quit. The storm on Eagle Summit was an extreme situation, but the Quest is known for its dangers. It's staged a month earlier than the Iditarod, when the north is colder and darker. Temperatures can get down to minus 60. Race Marshal Mike McCowan says the Quest's unpredictability is its signature.
It's just one challenge after the other. You've got the mountains, you've got the rivers, you've got the overflow, the distance. It's just all of those things combined, then the unknowns. And, you know, 1 minute you're standing there on your runners going, oh, life is good, da-da-da-da-da, and the whole world just seems to open up and swallow you out of the blue, you know. I mean, you lose a mitten. Your axe breaks, your sled runner busts. You just don't know what's coming next, and you just have to accept those things coming at you and be able to deal with them.
While the Iditarod has two dozen checkpoints, the Quest has only eight. The longest distance between them is over 200 miles. That means more time alone with dogs, camping in the wilderness, and carrying hundreds of pounds of food and gear. And with just 22 teams entered in this year's Quest, the trail was a lonely place. Alaskan Richie Beatty is one of just two rookies who finished last month's race.
Until now, I truly didn't understand what the word grueling meant. Grueling. The race is grueling. It breaks you down. You hear everyone talk about how they got depressed and just cracked. And it's just being on the 40-mile river in a deep canyon. And it's 20 below at 3 a.m. and you're tied to your sled and barely there. It all just becomes overwhelming and a bit too much.
Beatty says the toughest challenge is not letting the dogs see your distress. They pick up on a musher's emotions, and a team can literally get depressed. So Beatty talks to his dogs and even sings to them until the sun comes up. When the dogs respond, mushers say it's a feeling of accomplishment like no other. Alaskan Regina Wyckoff is the only other rookie to finish this year's race.
Everybody's working together, and when they got that good flow going, they kind of pick it up some, you know. They move a little faster, and there's a certain sound that you hear when the dog team's working together. You know, there's this kind of a jingle there, too. There's some people say they even breathe unison, you know. You'll hear a ha, 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 ha. I think that's when you see that they're really enjoying what they're doing.
It's been Wyckoff's dream to run the Quest. Although she came in last, she took 11th place in the smallest field of finishers in race history. Lance Mackey and three other Quest mushers will start today's Iditarod. For Only a Game, I'm Libby Casey in Fairbanks, Alaska.
This evening, the men's basketball teams from the University of North Carolina, currently ranked number 15 in the nation, and Duke University, currently ranked number 1, will meet for a game in Durham, North Carolina. Among the more passionate observers of that game will be Will Blythe, who begins his new book about the basketball rivalry between the two schools by declaring, "I am a sick, sick man." The title of the book is To Hate Like This is to Be Happy Forever. The subtitle, get ready, is a thoroughly obsessive, intermittently uplifting, and occasionally unbiased account of the Duke-North Carolina basketball rivalry. Will Blythe joins me now from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Will, welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to be here.
The two universities are only a few miles apart, and you maintain that they are nothing alike. What's the basic distinction between UNC and Duke?
Well, I think that North Carolina is the public institution, Duke the private. North Carolina draws most of its students from in-state, Duke from out-of-state. And most of the students that go to Duke will end up out-of-state. Most of North Carolina's will stay in-state. But then I also think basically one program is good, and one program is evil.
You're going to have to elaborate a little on that.
Well, no.
You say that so sweetly.
Do I really have to lie? It's not self-evident. The mythology I grew up with and how true it is, I guess, is one of the reasons I wrote the book, was to find out. But is, of course, that North Carolina is the public institution that serves the needs of its citizens, and Duke is an institution devoted to the advancement of the individual above all else. And so, of course, when you watch a basketball game, you like to feel, at least I did, sort of morally righteous about the team that you support. So that's how that happened.
What is it like to be in Chapel Hill or in Durham in the hours leading up to a game between these two teams?
It's really interesting, actually. You can feel the electricity, as they say, throughout the towns. During game time itself, it's as if it were a holiday. It's Christmas or something because the streets are quiet and everybody's inside watching the TV or else at the game. It really is. There's something just crackling and high voltage in the air at times like that.
Tonight's game will be in Cameron Indoor Stadium at Duke, a place you call a hellish hive of vituperation posing as wit. Are there particular chants that led to that characterization?
Well, there have been a great many over the years. And also just the I think for Duke students, because they're from out of state, and they're kind of passing through, they go to Cameron. I think it's sort of an act of collective theater, you know, the chants and so on. The rivalry is not quite as bred in the bone as I think it is for people who grew up in North Carolina, who I think see sometimes Duke as kind of as the interlopers. But the Duke students pride themselves on their chants and sort of clever gambits. And there was a guy actually last year when I was at the game there at Cameron that was terrifying to me, a guy named popularly known as Speedo Guy, who dresses only in a very skimpy brown Speedo, tennis shoes, and a Groucho Marx mustache and glasses. And it's his job, apparently, to try and distract the opposing team's shooters, in particular the Tar Heels, and he's really good at it.
And he's enormous.
He's big enough. I mean, you know, I think there may be multiple Speedo guys, but I think they tried out the biggest guy for the North Carolina game.
Readers won't be surprised at your enormous respect for former UNC coach Dean Smith and your affection for current coach Roy Williams. They may be surprised that you venture into the enemy camp in order to interview the man you call the Dark Prince. Were you worried that your hatred might be diminished once you had actually met Mike Krzyzewski?
Well, first I was worried that they were going to catch me. I felt like a spy behind enemy lines. And I thought that somehow I was going to just give myself away like, you know, a character in an Edgar Allan Poe story. But once I did actually shake hands with Krzyzewski, I was a little worried about the fact that I might actually like the guy. And we sat in his office, his old office, actually, in Cameron, and talked for a while. And he was a very charismatically intense guy. I can see why people would like to play for him. I did make him cry. And it was my long-term dream after 25 years of screaming at him on the TV. I'd always somehow wanted to cause him distress. And indeed, I won't say I caused him distress, but I made him cry. We started talking about our mothers. And he's very, very, he feels like basically all of his success in life has come because of his mother. And so he began to tear up when we were talking about her. And it's really hard to hate a man who is weeping with you as you talk about your mothers.
You speak of the coach as Coach Krzyzewski's old office. My understanding from your book is his new office is in some kind of multi-story fortress, utterly impregnable.
Yeah, they didn't let me in there. I did not make the security clearance. He's I think on the sixth floor of a tower, and actually to get in, you do have to have your hands scanned. There's a scanner, some sort of optical scanner, but they weren't letting me anywhere near that baby.
Your exploration of your own obsession leads you to meet with various other people, fans, one of whom is a man named Herb Neubauer, who at the age of 46, I'm quoting now, woke up one day and realized what his purpose in life was. And as it turned out, the man stopped working and became a full-time Duke basketball fan. Did this strike you as a good career choice?
Well, I mean, it certainly made him happy. He really has devoted his life the last close to 20 years to basically being a Duke fan. That's his identity. He's the crazy towel guy, and it's his job basically to wave the white towel, not of surrender, but of victory at the Duke games. And he actually has calculated the towel's winning percentage. I mean, he gave it to me one day. He said, the towel has won, you know, I think it was something like 79% or 80% of the games that it's been involved in. So he's a serious, serious fan.
But you maintain that you're not entirely immune to the syndrome apparent in Herb Neubauer's life. You write of yourself, apparently during all these years in which I had been gazing at either basketball or my navel, other folks much younger than I had been making impressive careers for themselves. Do you feel better now that at least you've gotten a book out of your obsession?
Yes, exactly. I got something out of it. I got this book. And yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, there were times when I would think as I was lying on the floor or attempting to affect the outcome of a game by various postures that I might take, that I thought to myself, you know, where is this going to lead? So it's one of the reasons I decided to write the book was just to explore how I got to be that way and, frankly, what was going to become of me.
Not surprisingly, there is a good deal of description of actual basketball in the book, and one of my favorite game action passages comes as you discuss North Carolina player Sean May. Would you please read from the middle paragraph on page 259?
Yes. And yet, no matter how much the basketball got battered back towards the shooter, Sean May kept emerging time and again out of scrums with the ball securely fastened to his hands. And once he got it, he usually found a way to lay it back on the board. For a player of his bulk, May had a surprisingly delicate touch. Watching him shoot was akin to watching a bear dine on salmon with a knife and fork. Such unexpected refinement captured one's notice. His feet were nimble, too. He drop-stepped, pivoted to beat double teams, and trapped defenders on his backside while he force-marched them under the basket. He was a conscientious student of all aspects of the game, not just its moves, but its history.
What do you suppose Sean May would make of being described as a bear with a knife and fork?
You know, I think he'd like it, actually. He was a very articulate guy. He was the kind of guy that you thought might have a career as a one of these TV commentators. He was incredibly articulate when it came to describing games and was really a student of the game and watched old players the way they played. So I think he might actually appreciate it.
The book ends with last year's NCAA tournament, which UNC won. Boy, you really picked the right year to write about North Carolina basketball, didn't you?
Yeah, the gods of basketball and publishing actually smiled down on me at the same time. It was a lucky thing. Yes, it was a double-double, exactly. Well said.
Let's get back to the present. Duke beat UNC by 3 points when they played at Chapel Hill on February 7th, and Duke has lost only 2 games all season, the second on Wednesday night. What's the chance your guys prevail on the road tonight?
I think the chances are actually pretty good. Now, I think the chances would be better had Duke not lost to Florida State, because apparently they have an astounding record after they've lost a game of winning the next game. Also, it's J.J. Redick's senior night and Sheldon Williams' senior night, so I think they're going to be really jazzed up for the game. But I've noticed that J.J. Redick's legs seem to be going over the last 3 games. I sound like a guy who's a student of horse racing, but I really think it affects his jump shot so much. And I think North Carolina actually has a really good chance to win this.
Any worries that at this game the Duke fans will recognize you as the guy who wrote about their program as the Dark Kingdom ruled over by the Dark Prince?
Well, I'm thinking of going in disguise, actually, as Speedo Guy, and I think there's no chance. No one will recognize me then, I hope.
Will Blythe is the author of To Hate Like This Is To Be Happy Forever, subtitled A Thoroughly Obsessive, Intermittently Uplifting, and Occasionally Unbiased Account of the Duke-North Carolina Basketball Rivalry, published by HarperCollins. He joined me from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Will, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can listen at your leisure to programs past and present on our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll learn what question preceded the answer, because Mommy won't let me play football. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The end of the universe was delayed until at least Monday because the NFL extended its free agency deadline 3 days so that the league and its alleged business partners could agree on a collective bargaining extension. Will the two sides be able to avoid an uncapped 2007 and an uncertain future beyond that?
Well, interestingly enough, of course, the baseball people must be rolling in the aisles at this, because football is constantly thrown at them as the way to do business.
Absolutely.
The way to run a league. And now every day gets another apocalyptic pronouncement from Paul Tagliabue. I'm surprised that there's as much support within the NFL as there is for getting rid of the salary cap entirely. Salary caps, as far as I'm concerned, have always been a political device rather than an economic device. It's a way to show you're keeping overpaid athletes in line. Doesn't make a lot of economic sense, really. But now you're seeing a lot of talk among some of the owners in the league that the salary cap is really unnecessary. Remember, the NFL achieved the parity and the popularity that made it the NFL without a salary cap. A salary cap is fairly recent. What we're dealing with here, of course, is the possibility that some owners, having defeated a salary cap, will then go after the revenue sharing, which really has been the basis of the NFL's success over the last 50 years, and that would be a catastrophe for the league.
Whatever the future of the salary cap may be, teams cut players in anticipation of the 2006 salary cap, which has been set at $94.5 million earlier this week. Any surprises?
Not any real surprises, but apparently the Kansas City Chiefs have decided to revamp their entire defense. They got rid of two cornerbacks and two linebackers right off the top on March 2nd. So I think that what you are seeing is teams behaving like there's a salary cap, even though there may not be one.
Team USA has announced its training camp roster for the 2006 World Championship and beyond. Does the current group of hoopsters give the U.S. a chance to avoid the kind of debacles we saw during the Athens Summer Games and in previous World Championships as well?
I don't know, but perceived conduct apparently was very big on putting this roster together. The notable omission, of course, is Allen Iverson, for which Jerry Colangelo and whoever else is helping him put this organization together should be ashamed of themselves. Nobody played harder at the last Olympics than Allen Iverson. Nobody represented his country better at the last Olympics than Allen Iverson did. He deserved to be back with these guys. The fact that he's not has a lot to do with the fact that Jerry Colangelo is kind of a stiff-necked, semi-hypocritical moralist and always has been. Otherwise, you know, the lineup are the usual suspects: LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Dwayne Wade. I would point out, by the way, that Carmelo Anthony is on the roster and behaved like a four-year-old at the last Olympics. So I'm not exactly sure what we're shooting for here.
The NCAA has claimed that its new academic progress rates will help guarantee that college athletes are also college students. Does the report that was released on Wednesday support that contention?
Well, I have to, with this latest cosmetic fig leaf phony device from the NCAA, which is guaranteed to give the appearance of reform without actually costing the NCAA any money, I have to go along with Pat Forty, who summoned up the famous 1980s quote about NCAA compliance, that the NCAA was so mad at Kentucky it gave Cleveland State 3 more years of probation. Just for the football teams that were whacked by this new reform movement, we have Temple, Toledo, Middle Tennessee State, Western Michigan, Buffalo, not the Bills, the university, New Mexico State, Northern Illinois, and Hawaii. Now, come on. We're not reforming anywhere where it might cost us dough.
Barry Bonds Incorporated announced that he will not submit to interviews except with reporters who sign releases allowing Bonds to show them on his upcoming reality show on ESPN. Just a case of a man protecting his multiple investments, right?
Well, I mean, I despair of ESPN ever drawing a line at anything, but what are they doing involved in something like this?
Conflict of interest is not in their vocabulary.
ESPN is not going to require its reporters to sign these waivers. So apparently this is coming directly from, as you put it, Barry Bonds Incorporated, the media relations department of Barry Bonds Incorporated.
Speaking of shakers,
I think I would probably sign Clark Kent or something on my waiver.
Speaking of shakers of money trees, Bob Knight's new reality show is off to a rather inauspicious start. Have you seen Night School?
I saw a little bit of it. It's actually not a terrible idea. Of course, the problem is, it being television and basic cable at that, you can't show the Bob Knight everybody wants to see.
Roger Clemens, temporarily at least of the Houston Astros, is experimenting once again to see if he wants to pitch for still another summer. I understand that whether he continues to play or not, he will come away from spring training with at least one memorable pitcher-batter confrontation.
There's an old joke that pops up in the movie Major League where they say some pitcher is so nasty he threw at his kid in a father-and-son game. Clemens has now actually done it.
He did it.
His son Kobe hit one over the fence, and he buzzed him in the ribs with the next pitch. And both sides laughed, and it was actually, for Roger, a very nice human moment.
The Baseball Hall of Fame will induct its first woman this summer, Charlie, as a result of a special committee's recent deliberations. To what extent did the committee get these deliberations right?
Well, to a major extent, they got them wrong, which we'll get to in a minute. Because I'm telling you, if Effa Manley were alive, she would be outraged that Buck O'Neill was not put in the Baseball Hall of Fame. I don't know who these people are. I don't know what they were thinking. But if you needed any more proof that the Baseball Hall of Fame has a limitless capacity for making reasonable people behave like jackasses, this is it.
And this is not only a question of a deserving candidate. It would have been a public relations bonanza. I mean, you'd think they'd at least consider their own self-interest.
What have they deprived themselves of? Buck O'Neill has already said he'll show up and accept on behalf of the people, because none of the people they actually put in are still alive. He will show up at the age of 94 having had his eye spit in and give a speech for these people. I'm telling you one thing. The people who run the Baseball Hall of Fame, top to bottom, including the people who vote for it, aren't worthy to tie Buck O'Neill's shoes.
And finally, Charlie, it's not unusual for pro and college sports arenas and stadia to double as concert venues, of course. But isn't Washington State University taking that synthesis to a new level with the announcement of their basketball team's next coach?
Well, Tony Bennett has heard this, I'm sure, since the time he was 3 years old and his father did him the great disservice of naming him Tony Bennett. He will become the basketball coach, replacing his father, Dick Bennett, who moved from Washington State from the University of Wisconsin. This is now becoming something of a pattern in college basketball. Pat Knight is next on the runway at Texas Tech when Bob hangs it up, and Sean Sutton is going to replace Eddie Sutton because his career at Oklahoma State is pretty much finished. So, I mean, I guess as a silver dollar goes from hand to hand, job goes from father to son.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me here at Only a Game each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Ah, it's March. Time for the annual spectacle of bouncing basketballs and brainy bracketology. But the calendar's third month is also crunch time for fencing, gymnastics, ice hockey, and the other college winter sports, like the one Only a Game's Karen Given recently observed in the college sports hotbed of Las Vegas.
With five national championships and occasional ink on the police blotter, everyone's heard of the University of Nebraska football team. But although the Cornhuskers of the Gridiron are still the kings of the campus, they have some new competition in the form of Adrian Miller and Amanda Burgoyne.
Yeah, we have articles written about us, and people know that we're like we have these huge rings, so they always ask us about them, and it's cool.
They've all seen us on ESPN2 for the NCAA championships, and actually after winning the first year, then everybody realized that we do have a bowling team and we are really good.
That's right. Amanda and Adrian are varsity bowlers. 3 years ago, women's bowling became an NCAA sport, and with that distinction came scholarships, athletic department funding, and the promise of some serious competition.
I have no idea where we're going. So.
48 teams from California to New Jersey crowd the Gold Coast Bowling Center in Las Vegas for January's Brunswick Coca-Cola Classic, one of the biggest tournaments of the year. Nebraska's had a full-time coach and former Pro Tour bowler Bill Straub since 1992. But when the sport went varsity in 2004, Coach Straub decided to ramp up his program, and his efforts have paid off with wins in the first two NCAA championships.
We tried. Yep, it's not just eating pizza while you bowl anymore.
There's a governing body within our athletic department that takes care of every activity they do, from cardiovascular benefits, certainly strength training. There's a psychologist on board. There's a nutritionist on board. And I miss the academic counselor. I should have started with that one. So that every area of their life, should they have a concern about that, there's someone on staff to make it go better. And hopefully us with the bowling side.
The reason for bowling's big break is simple. Division I schools like Nebraska have traditionally had trouble balancing out 85 football scholarships with an equal number of opportunities on the women's side. As they struggle to comply with Title IX, schools have found some creative avenues to balance participation without breaking the bank. And Coach Straub says that struggle has been nothing but good for bowling.
Bowling's biggest trouble, by my definition, is image. It's always been, is this really a sport or is it a recreation? When the NCAA adopted it for use for Title IX reasons, for political gain, they made a stamp of approval that now, definitively, it's by their definition a sport. Regardless of what the qualifications might be, they say it's a sport. End of argument. I think that's a big plus.
The entire approach is just glue. Watch.
Nebraska's men's team has been assigned to a sticky lane at the far end of the bowling center. Eric Vermilia and his teammates are also known for being successful. But as a club sport, Eric says, they don't enjoy the same benefits as the women's team.
Well, it's a good time at least. You know, we raise all our own money with raffles and that kind of stuff. But yeah, we have to drive ourselves up to the tournament. But it's fun. You know, something to do. We drove to South Bend last weekend. It was like a 13-hour drive.
Do you ever just want to hitch a ride with the ladies?
We'd love to, yeah, but they don't let us. So they got that nice bus with like three TVs in it. It'd be nice.
Eric and his teammates don't have strength trainers or team psychologists. They rent their own practice time at a local bowling center and bowl in leagues to stay in shape. Why do they bother?
That's a good question.
It's because mommy wouldn't let me play football.
1, 2, 3! Oh! Oh! Oh!
With a long day of bowling to come, teams don't waste time getting started. Each player will bowl a grueling 7 games today, with 12 more in what's called the Baker style tomorrow. One bowler tells me that she'll throw the equivalent of 2 tons of weight down the lane over the course of the weekend. But it wasn't a better understanding of bowling's athleticism that led Vanderbilt to add the sport to its roster, at least not according to Sports Information Director Rod Williamson.
We started women's bowling a year ago comply with the Title IX and NCAA requirements that we added women's sport. We thought it was something we wouldn't need to build a facility, for example, and that, I mean, to be honest, it would be a low investment compared to adding a softball or a volleyball that would require a lot more personnel.
Among the schools offering NCAA bowling, Vanderbilt is ranked first academically. But Williamson says the university hasn't had any trouble attracting bowlers who can live up to those standards. In fact, the bowling team has the highest GPA among Vanderbilt's sports teams.
There's 11 women on the team, and 10 of them were over 3.0. So they're pre-med majors, and they're people that have came to Vanderbilt for the academics. A couple people that are in engineering honor societies and all. So it's an interesting group to work with.
In just their second year, the women of Vanderbilt haven't had time to develop traditions. The same cannot be said of Jillian Pavlak and the bowling team from the University of Central Florida.
We make up cheers in our spare time. It's sad but true, but yeah, we cheer a lot, and we find that cheering definitely helps our bowling. It helps us keep ourselves pepped up, and we bowl better when we cheer, so we do it as much as we can.
In fact, UCF's coaching staff, led by Hall of Fame bowler Pat Costello, has made the cheering a requirement.
That's my favorite cheer, because that means she got a strike. But I'm in the bathroom sometimes. I know how they're bowling just by what cheer they say.
Unlike Vanderbilt, the UCF bowling team has been on the college club circuit for years, building a reputation as a strong competitor. But bowling isn't a varsity sport at UCF. The coaching staff is volunteer. Costello works for a local bowling center, which also provides practice time. Other expenses have to be covered by the team.
Our athletes, the men and women athletes, raise over $55,000 a year in which to compete. We're very fortunate in the fact that I was on the tour for 20 or 30 years. I forget how long that was, but, you know, it was a long time. And so I've known a few people in my career, and they've done me some very nice favors coming back to support these fine athletes. But to have scholarships for these women bowlers would just be the epitome of it all.
Costello will take her case to the UCF Board of Trustees later this month, and she hopes that soon those scholarships will be in place. But no matter how successful she is in front of the board, the same benefits will not be extended to UCF's men's bowling team. Bowling is not, and likely never will be, an NCAA sport for men. On the women's side of the Gold Coast Bowling Center, family members cheer and coaches rush to offer advice and assistance. The varsity women wear crisp, professional uniforms and use matching shoes and equipment, no doubt supplied by official sponsors. On the men's side, there's considerably less commotion, and those crisp uniforms are replaced by battered polo shirts and wrinkled khakis. But ask Anthony Stato, a sophomore on Sacred Heart University's B team, and he says there's nowhere he'd rather be.
It's the life I want to live the rest of my life, but I'm only in college 4 years. Otherwise, I'd be with these guys every day. Nothing wrong with this at all.
As Anthony talks, the A and B teams crowd around. It's clear they're not used to getting attention.
I mean, we're cooler than the football players and the basketball players and the hockey players and the basketball players. But, you know, we are obviously probably the best team in the whole world, maybe even on the whole campus.
Yeah, you get all the write-ups in the school paper.
The school paper wouldn't waste its ink on us, but... That's only because they don't know the adjectives to use to describe our greatness. But if they did, they would.
6 weeks from now, Nebraska will try for its third Division I championship at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, Texas. 1 week later, UCF and the other club teams will vie for the Intercollegiate Team Championship at the Cherry Bowl in Rockford, Illinois. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Gabriel Scruggs and George Hicks and from Tina Simmons at WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out Sean Cole's South African Baseball Photo Gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Vanderbilt Sports Information Director Rod Williamson. When asked by Only a Game's Karen Given if his school's new bowling center would offer bowling's official drink, beer.
Well, iced tea, maybe, sugar, maybe.
Yeah. Right, and I bet the new Vanderbilt Bowling Alley, center, won't have polka music, throwback jerseys, funny shoes, or women named Laverne, Shirley, or Trixie either. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National Public.